This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
New approach for the opioid crisis. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending some time with us on this Labor Day weekend. Here's what's coming up during this hour. A city in New Hampshire is opening its fire stations to addicts who need immediate help. Find out how the program works. Also, those long TSA lines that kicked off summer travel season on Memorial Day have largely vanished as we approach Labor Day. We'll examine who gets credit. Plus, if rain threatens your outdoor grilling plans this holiday weekend, we'll have tips for getting it done in the worst conditions. And as the college football season kicks off in earnest, we'll examine the newest trend on the sideline.
College football coaches have so much to worry about. They have maybe 100 players. They have dozens of staff members. They have to worry about recruiting 100 more players. They have these giant, giant programs that they have to oversee, and there's a lot for them to worry about. But at the end of the day, they were usually hired as a head coach because they were really good at something like drawing up defensive schemes or calling offensive plays or something along those lines.
Andrew Beaton at the Wall Street Journal on college football coaches returning to a hands-on approach. He's here in about 25 minutes. Well, in response to a drug epidemic, New Hampshire is trying a new and different approach. In Manchester, a hotspot in the nation's raging addiction to opioids, such as heroin, they've opened the doors of fire stations to addicts. Wall Street Journal reporter John Camp paid a visit. John, set the scene.
New Hampshire really has a pretty tough problem right now with opioid drugs, and those are drugs like heroin and prescription pain pills or knockoffs of those pills, and in particular lately, this bootleg version of the drug fentanyl. And the problem is really, really prevalent in Manchester, the largest city up there, which has about 110,000 people. And, you know, this can be really, really frustrating for first responders because they see addicts all the time, but they only see them at the worst moment, when they overdosed and often when they died. And so what the fire department up there came up with was a new plan where they basically open the doors of the 10 fire stations as sort of a safe haven where addicts can come to them anytime, and, you know, they're not going to risk getting arrested, and instead they're going to get help. The firefighters are going to basically call someone over from a nonprofit and try and plug them in right away to services, so if they want to get treatment, they can.
Wow. How bad are things statistic-wise, John, in, say, Manchester or New Hampshire as a whole?
It's bad. It's really bad. New Hampshire, which isn't a big state, had well over 400 drug-related deaths last year, and that more than doubled the number from just 2 years earlier, and the number is projected to rise again this year. And so far in just Manchester, this is really up to date through late August, there has been 524 drug overdoses in the city, and 70 of them are fatal. So you look at that rate and you just realize that, you know, multiple times a day, first responders are rushing off to an overdose.
My goodness. All right, so how does it work with these firehouses then? What happens when somebody has a problem? What's the kind of the step-by-step?
Sure. So I saw this in person, and what happens is someone comes into the firehouse. Usually it's the central fire station downtown, and, you know, an alarm code rings out, and the firefighters kind of gather around the person. And the first thing they're going to do is just make sure that you don't have a physical problem that, you know, requires immediate transport to the hospital. And typically you don't. And then, you know, in one instance that I witnessed, a guy had some needles in a crack pipe, and he was able to just kind of dump those into a protective container. And really within a matter of minutes, they talked to him a little bit. They had, like a peer counselor come over from a local nonprofit that's just down the street. And, you know, within maybe 15 minutes, he was walking off to go, to go talk to them about treatment options. And hopefully that ended up being a pathway for him to get the treatment.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter John Camp about his piece entitled Fire Stations Open Their Doors to Addicts. He's talking specifically about a new program in Manchester, New Hampshire. Is this being replicated elsewhere? Do we know?
There's certainly a lot of interest in it, and that's a really good question because, you know, as I said at the outset here, this is such a common problem for first responders around the U.S. And, you know, I should note there's was a novel program started in the city of Gloucester, Massachusetts last year where they used police stations for this, or police officers, really. And one of the concerns in Manchester was that, you know, that's a smart idea, but they were a bit concerned that many addicts are afraid of police and might feel more comfortable with firefighters. And also because firehouses tend to be scattered strategically around a city, it gives people a lot of entry points to get help.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of interest in this, particularly in New Hampshire. One of the challenges, though, is that some cities just don't have good services to back it up. And I'll give you an example. Nashua, New Hampshire, is the second largest city in that state. And they're interested in doing this, but their concern is that if someone shows up, they don't have a place to send them for help. They don't have, you know, folks from a nonprofit who can rush in and say, what can we do for you? So I think it's really going to come down to what kind of services there are to back something up like this. And then one final point is that this might be a program that, works best in cities that have, you know, pretty robust fire stations that are well-staffed and ready to handle any, you know, safety or security concerns that pop up. At least that's the opinion of a firefighter up in Concord, New Hampshire, who was a bit critical on social media of the program, just worried that there could be, safety concerns,
yeah.
If someone unstable came into the firehouse.
And if you turn yourself, not turn yourself in, but I mean, if you show up at a firehouse desperate for help, no criminal charges of any kind?
That's not the plan, no.
Okay.
Like I said, the one example, you know, I saw was a guy with some paraphernalia, and he was able to dump it in a box, no questions asked.
Okay.
And in fact, in many ways, a model for this program was like the safe haven laws that let someone show up with a newborn infant to a firehouse or a church or something like that and essentially leave the infant and not have to worry about any, legal repercussions.
Thanks, John. Wall Street Journal reporter John Camp, as he says in the story, before Safe Station, as it's called, firefighters who encountered addicts could hand them help cards with names and numbers to call, but they didn't really know what happened to them after that. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Glad you're with us. Hey, remember those long airport security lines that became a big travel story earlier this year? They appear to have faded away, a welcome development for flyers after the loud public outcry that reached its peak just ahead of the busy summer travel season. It's a story from Ben Mutzaba, who writes a blog for USA Today called Today in the Sky. Ben, what do we have?
As everyone probably remembers, we had these huge lines that really started to become a big, big national story in May, especially kind of reached its crescendo, and everyone was worried about how poorly things were going to go over the summer with long lines and people missing their flights and all of that. And then here we are approaching Labor Day, and it's pretty much not a problem anymore. So in an era where we're used to the TSA maybe, you know, being the punchline of a late-night talk show, they actually did a pretty good job of turning around what looked like it was going to be a fairly dire summer. And, of course, the airlines pitched in, and, of course, you always have your grandstanding politicians who, since a political opportunity, they pitched in a little bit to help. But, you know, again, in an era where things generally seem to go wrong in the public spotlight like this, people sounded the alarm, and by golly, here we are on Labor Day, and the problem seems to be mostly fixed.
Wow. All right, so if we survive the summer, though, what does this mean? We've got Labor Day weekend coming up, then we're heading into the fall. Is there reason to hold out hope that this will continue?
Well, that's a great question, and I think the thing to remember here is that, hey, it's great that we've got this what looked like a huge problem heading into the summer solved, but, you know, TSA and security in general is a moving target, and that also includes the lines. So TSA and the airlines and airports did a lot of clever things to help fix this. There's the obvious one. TSA has upped its staffing at a lot of the busiest airports where we were seeing the longest lines. And that may seem obvious, but, you know, there's money that had to be shifted around. It's not like they can just arbitrarily increase their own budget. That, of course, goes through our friends at Congress in Washington. So they shifted some money around, which allowed that to happen as far as the increase in staffing. The airlines kicked in some of their own money and their own staffing to hire people who could help with non-essential TSA duties, like, you know, collecting bins, directing people in lines, that type of thing. So that helped now, but, you know, especially as we get toward the end of the year and we hit a new financing reset, all that type of thing, we have to hope these things continue. And I'm optimistic based on what I've seen and based on the outcry from what we saw this summer that no one wants to end up back where we started. But, yeah, it is something to keep an eye out. I think Labor Day will be normal busy but not crisis busy. Yeah. I think, you know, always when you head into Thanksgiving and Christmas, those are just busy, busy time periods, and there are going to be long lines everywhere, including at the airport and at the security lines. But I'm not expecting at this point to see anything that's going to take us back to that talk closer to Memorial Day, where we were really worried about how this was going to turn out.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ben Mutzabah. He's the editor of the Today in the Sky blog for USA Today, covers the airline industry. His piece is called "Remember Those Long TSA Lines? Poof, They're Gone." All right, so you alluded to it a little bit in terms of moving around money. What about the cost?
Well, right now, you know, this has been, except for the airlines, this has been, we'll say mostly neutral as far as the TSA is concerned. They've shifted money out of other silos that was intended to pay for down-the-road training and some facilities and things like that, and they've brought that in to increase overtime pay and up staffing. So, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out into the next budget. Of course, you can imagine there'll be a request to increase the number of staffers to keep up with the to maintain the number of staffers and increase the future staffers to keep up with the increasing number of flyers. This has been a record year for air travel, which is contributing to the problem, or had contributed to the problem. So we'll see that. Now, I think what will be interesting to see is that the airlines have ponied up their own money, a couple million dollars for each airline, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is a drop in the bucket for, you know, airlines that report revenue in the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. Yeah. So will they continue to fund some of these part-time or contractor workers who are helping to do the non-essential things, like guide people into lines, to retrieve bins, that type of thing? I suspect they probably will, just because no one wants to go back to where we were. And, you know, so right now I would say it's a holding period where I'm optimistic. I don't think that we're going to see, we've not seen any direct costs from this for the TSA, but we are going to see it possibly coming up when it's time to renew their budget. And as you know, how things go in Washington, that's always an unpredictable event that often turns into a circus sideshow.
Thanks, Ben. Ben Mutzabah. The blog at USA Today is called Today in the Sky. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. In fast-moving housing markets, many sellers worry that once they've found someone to buy their place, they won't have enough time to secure another home for themselves. And some people, especially those with families, would rather not move twice, of course, before finding a permanent home. So what's a family to do? Here's MarketWatch reporter Amy Hoke. Amy, what's the market like right now?
Well, you know, inventory is tight in a lot of housing markets around the country. And so when people are trying to move up, they're trying to sell their home and buy another, some people, they're worried that they're going to not be able to find a place to live that they like in the amount of time that they have between the time they find a buyer for their home, their existing home, and the closing, basically. That's, for some people, that's causing them to not move at all. They're staying put. Some people are putting money into their homes. They're doing some remodeling. But for people who really do want to move, they want to make a move and they know things are going to move really quick, we kind of looked at some options for them to buy them a little bit more time or kind of make sure that they're not going to have to do an in-between. Because I think a lot of people fear that, oh, we're going to sell the house, we're going to have to be out, we're going to have to rent or live with family. and then, you know, until we find a permanent place to live. And I think especially for families, that's not the best option.
Very daunting. All right. So some of the options could be what, for example?
Well, you know, I talked with one realtor who said that more and more he's putting a contingency on the contract for the seller. So basically, the contract, when the potential buyer they put an offer in, the seller counters and says, look, we'll sell the house, but we need to find a new home of our choice to live in before we close. So it's kind of a flip of what maybe people are more accustomed to when a seller goes out and they find a home that they like and they say, you know, we're going to buy this house if we can sell our current house. That doesn't really work too much these days because it's such a tight market. Sellers are going to accept the best offer that they get. And if there's a chance it's not going to go through, you know, they might not be up for that. So they're kind of doing it the other way. Buyer comes interested in buying your property, say, yep, we're interested in selling, but there's a contingency, and that is we have to find a home to buy before we'll close. So there's a time limit that usually put on it. Maybe the seller says we want an extra 30 to 45 days to kind of figure out where we want to live and settle on that, get the wheels turning there. You know, if the time period goes by and then the seller hasn't found a place to live, the buyer can back out of the contract, or maybe they stick around and say, you know, we'll work with you until you find a place to buy yourself. But it is one option, and there's pluses and minuses to it as well.
We're speaking with Market Watch reporter Amy Hoke. Her story is called Need to Buy a House Fast After Selling Yours. Don't panic. Here's what to do. All right, so what else is out there?
So the other thing, too, is a rent back. So that's maybe a little bit more common. You find the buyer. You say in the contract, we need to find a home as well. If we need to close before we close on our next home, please rent the house back to us so that we don't have to move out right away.
Thanks, Amy. Market Watch reporter Amy Hoke. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Trips to the post office are never convenient, so why not get postage right from your desk with Stamps.com? Stamps.com even gives you special postage discounts you can't get at the post office, including first class, priority mail, express, international, and more. You'll never pay full price for postage again. Here's how Stamps.com works. Using your own computer and printer, buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then just hand your mail to the mailman or drop it in a mailbox. It's that easy. Currently, over 600,000 small businesses are using Stamps.com. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Get started with Stamps.com today. Go to Stamps.com. Then before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in DEAL. That's Stamps.com. Then enter the code DEAL. Thanks for spending time with us on this Labor Day weekend. I'm Gordon Deal. Coming up this half hour, the new trend in college football coaching, how streaming came to dominate the music industry, and tips for grilling when it's supposed to rain on your Labor Day party. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. The era of delegating duties like play calling may be dying in college football. Some coaches are returning to the hands-on approach. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
As we kick off the college football season this weekend, here's a novel idea. Head coaches are actually coaching again. Andrew Beaton of the Wall Street Journal has more on the men who are getting back in the sideline action after years of pulling back to be more of a CEO. Andrew, why are some big-name coaches putting the headsets back on?
It's an interesting question, and you've seen so many coaches really adopt this CEO-like mentality, and it's understandable. College football coaches have so much to worry about. They have maybe 100 players. They have dozens of staff members. They have to worry about recruiting 100 more players. They have these giant, giant programs that they have to oversee, and there's a lot for them to worry about. But at the end of the day, they were usually hired as a head coach because they were really good at something, like drawing up defensive schemes or calling offensive plays or something along those lines. And it can be difficult for them to actually do that when they're a head coach. And there's been a number of high-profile head coaches, from Auburn's Gus Malzahn to Mark Richt, going over to Miami after he was fired at Georgia and saying, you know, one of the things I really have to do is get back into this, because it's fun. It's what made me a good and attractive head coaching candidate in the first place, and I think it's going to help us win.
Talk a little bit more about Mark Richt. What was he doing at Georgia, and what is he changing at Miami?
Well, in his last several years at Georgia, he had handed off the offensive play calling duties to an offensive coordinator. And what he was saying when we talked was, I knew if I took another head coaching job, I would want to coach the quarterbacks. I would want to call plays. I'd want to be in those meetings. And that's exactly what he's doing at Miami, where he has a great quarterback in Brad Kaya, who's arguably one of the best in the entire country. And he's really trying to get back into the nitty-gritty. And this is what made him an attractive candidate in the first place when Georgia first hired him. He's a great offensive coordinator and great quarterbacks coach at Florida State. And that's what got his name on the map as a coach. And so he's really returning to his roots, and something he did early on in his tenure at Georgia, but something he got away from just because the responsibilities of being a head coach can be pretty daunting.
And is that more or less the career track for a head coach to come up through the ranks as an assistant coach and specializing in something?
Yeah, definitely. Like, Richt had played quarterback in college at Miami, and he had a specialty there. So he ended up becoming a coach and working his way up through the ranks as an assistant to a head coaching job. And it's just this strange thing where, as a head coach, if you give up those play calling duties, you're strangely removed from what made you so great in the first place. And it's the fun part of being a coach, getting to manage everything. And at the end of the day, if you're not calling those plays, if you have an offensive coordinator calling your offensive plays, a defensive coordinator calling your defensive plays, there isn't that much on game day that the coach is doing. But sure, they're calling timeouts and they're dictating the general tone of what they want, but they're also handing off the play calling, which is the real big thing, to two other people. And a lot of these guys really want to get back into that.
Andrew, do schools' athletic directors and or university boards want to see the CEO thing? Do they want to see the coaching thing? Or is it just up to the individual situation?
I think they want to see wins. So however they do that. And there have been coaches who do amazingly both ways. Like, Nick Saban doesn't call the offensive or defensive plays, but he also had a huge impact in the national championship game when he made that broader decision to go for that onside kick, and that's what put them over the top against Clemson. They're still involved in those bigger things, and credit to Nick Saban, who also is one of the coaches who's super, super involved with special teams. But then there's coaches like Florida State's Jimbo Fisher, who has always stayed closely involved with the play calling. And so there's ways to win both ways, and I think that's generally what they want to see.
The Wall Street Journal's Andrew Beaton with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Our move as consumers away from owning music to renting it from services like Spotify and Apple Music has caught fire. Streaming is now the biggest revenue source for the U.S. recorded music industry, passing downloads and CDs at the end of 2015. Wall Street Journal reporter Neil Shah says streaming, once a niche music format, hit its cultural tipping point this summer. Neil, what's up here?
Well, basically, we've had a lot of activity this summer and this year when it comes to music streaming. For a long time, music streaming, meaning listening on things like Spotify or Apple Music or Tidal, or indeed just looking up stuff on YouTube, for a long time, it's been kind of a niche activity in terms of the music business. But financially, in terms of the music business, and then now culturally, we've definitely hit a tipping point. And so what I looked at is some of the key things that have happened this year. One thing that I think a lot of people would be aware of is the enormous popularity of the hip-hop star Drake's new album, Views, which has been number one on the Billboard 200 album chart for 12 weeks so far this year. The thing is, Drake's album's not selling a whole lot of copies, really, except for the first couple of weeks. Drake's album is number one on the charts because so many people around the country are streaming that album so much. And that's one example of how streaming is kind of starting to take over the business. For example, starting with the Billboard charts that we all watch to see who's number one, two, three, et cetera.
Right. Do artists make less money if we're not buying and we're streaming? But they're still getting some cut of the action, right?
That's a good question. There is a big debate afoot about royalties. How much should artists get? What's fair in terms of royalties from streaming services like Spotify, which has a free option and a paid option, Apple Music, which has which is only a paid option, and then also YouTube, which where you can just go online and look up a Drake video. Artists and labels have long complained that the royalties are not sufficient. To give you an example, a typical royalty payment for one stream would be about 1 cent. 1 cent a stream.
Yeah. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Neil Shah. So as the headline says, if this is the summer that streaming took over, do you think that that means for the foreseeable future we'll have record numbers every summer or every year?
Right. The numbers of streamers are going up. I mean, already so many people, already 75% of Americans are at least using YouTube to every now and then look up a song. And we're not even talking about things like Spotify and Apple Music.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So streaming has definitely caught on. And as more and more people stream, you're going to get bigger and bigger streaming records. And you'll continually probably have these summers where you have blockbusters like Drake's Views. The industry is changing to adapt to this new world.
Thanks, Neil. Wall Street Journal reporter Neil Shah. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. If you're looking to grow or relocate your business, there are three numbers you should know. 10, 2000, and 6. 10 stands for Michigan being one of America's top 10 states for business. 2000 is the number of burdensome regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years. And 6 stands for Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climates. All those numbers add up to the one state that has all that and more. Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. That's MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Thanks for spending time with us. Ever feel inspired or turned off by a campaign ad? May have a lot to do with the music in it. Eric Felton, managing editor at the Weekly Standard, says now that campaigns are in full swing, we won't be able to escape what he calls the silly season soundtrack, the music that underpins TV and radio ads. Eric, explain.
You know, there's a whole industry of providing music for political ads out there. And it's developed over the years from the earliest years of the Republic when people used to sing campaign songs to now when every political ad uses the kind of music that you might get in a second-rate horror film to signal how terrible the other guy is. And it's such a standard part of campaigns these days that there is a whole industry, large companies that that make a business of providing the horror soundtrack for use in political campaign ads.
I mean, how long has music like this been around?
Well, you know, music for political purposes goes all the way back to the beginning of the Republic with campaign songs for candidates. But this new use of treating music in politics in a cinematic way, using it to bring out emotions in people as they see images in an advertisement, that really got its start in the 1968 Nixon campaign, where he hired a filmmaker named Eugene Jones to produce some really innovative political advertisements. And those ads showed all sorts of violent still images from the Democratic convention in Chicago that year and other rioting that was going on in the late 60s. And he used music really in an innovative way, and he would take sound and put it through electronic loops, and it would be sounding disorienting and disturbing, and it really bolstered the images that were there. And it invented this sort of new way of treating political ads like little films and using music like you would use music in a film to produce emotional states in the viewer.
We're speaking with Eric Felton, managing editor at the Weekly Standard. His piece is called The Soundtrack of the Silly Season. Take us through the years a little bit here about presidential candidates, for example, who've had some catchy tunes.
Yeah, you know, there's always been music for rallies, which is a little different than music for political advertisements. And at rallies, you want to get a song that people know that kind of gets them hyped up. And so You go back and Franklin Roosevelt had Happy Days Are Here Again. Jack Kennedy turned to Frank Sinatra, who had had a hit with the song High Hopes in the late 50s, and they reworked the lyrics and made it that, you know, Jack Kennedy's got high hopes, and Sinatra sang a version that had Kennedy-specific lyrics. And it still goes on now where, you know, Hillary Clinton uses fight song, Donald Trump uses Rolling Stones tunes, and of course the Rolling Stones complain and tell him to stop, but they can't make him stop. So that use of political music is really what taps into the sort of longest tradition in American politics. The use for sort of advertisements is this thing that is much newer.
So the songs that the campaigns find, this is stuff that's, say, already in existence, available for purchase, or does a company actually draw something up from scratch, or both?
You know, if you're a really big budget campaign, a presidential campaign, you may have a number of spots where you go to a guy who does ad music, you know, music for advertisements, and you have something custom written for you.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Felton, managing editor at the Weekly Standard. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. If it looks like your Labor Day is going to be washed out by rain, but you've got guests expecting grilled food, here are some ideas on getting it done from HowStuffWorks.com. 1. Try umbrellas made especially to shelter grills. Typically, they clamp onto the grill's table or fit over it and rest on the ground. 2. Rather than having one lone person hover around a closed grill, you know, like you, while others wait inside, cook on an open fire pit. Invite everyone outside. 3. Indirect grilling. Good choices for indirect grilling in bad weather include large cuts of meat that can cook on their own for long periods without your constant basting of them. This may be the time to try grilling a beef roast, pork tenderloin, whole chicken, or leg of lamb. 4, cheat a little. You might wrap the foods in foil, place them on a grill over medium heat, close the lid, and wait. Or try microwaving your food first. Start cooking the food in the microwave while the grill is heating. Cook until it's nearly done, then finish on the grill. 5, this one's from my own personal playbook. Keep Golden Garden or Lucky Star or Panda House Chinese restaurants on speed dial. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Thanks for listening, and we'd love to hear from you. Leave a review and comment for us on iTunes. For more from This Morning Show, check us out at thismorningwithgordondeal.com.